2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 236, celebrating the life of a Mormon and a human, in memoriam session for Eugene England. A panel discussion featuring Toby Pingree, Albert Eugene Peck, Levi S. Peterson, and Jeff Pingree.
About him. I recognize that saintliness is a dubious quality to attribute to anyone. It implies a terrifying rigor, an uncompromising surrender of the self to God's ways and wishes. One way to achieve saintliness is to define it downward. I believe, for example, that you do define it downward when you officially attribute it to an entire church. Being a Mormon of record, even a slouching, dilatory keeper of the commandments like myself qualifies. I believe, moreover, that you define saintliness downward when you ascribe it even to a select core of church-attending, tithe-paying, word-of-wisdom-keeping members. I'm afraid that all too often, even those who believe themselves qualified candidates for the title of saintliness have missed its point. But as for Gene, yes, I'll vote for his saintliness. I first became intimately acquainted with Gene and Charlotte when early in 1991 they joined a writing group to which Althea and I belonged. On a Sunday evening in March of 1992, we drove to Provo to attend a session of this writing group at the home of Gene and Charlotte. It was our custom that the writer at whose home we were assembling distributed a manuscript in advance, which following dinner we critiqued. That is what we did on that occasion, the occasion of which I speak. And upon our return from Provo that evening, I recorded the following in my diary, quoting, "Charlotte is a fine cook and a beautiful person. There are slight frictions and humorous protests between her and the great Christian. This only half-satirical appellation for Gene occurs to me because of his dogged insistence on not explaining to his reader that the Christ-like relation of the two men in his personal essay, Monte Cristo, which we discussed, is the essay's great point. Gene lives, eats, breathes the commandment to love one another. He suffers over conflict of all kinds, from war to backbiting. In his presence, I appreciate freshly the sham of my intimacy with so many Mormons. I rarely think of Christ. I am a hardened naturalist." End quote. This passage from my diary will bear elaboration. No one who observed the utter devotion which Charlotte paid to Gene during his final illness will doubt her love for him. Yet during their ordinary times together, their happy times, I might add, there was this slight, satirical, humorous protest on Charlotte's part, which Gene calmly ignored. I understood Charlotte perfectly. Gene was indeed a little obtuse, a little bullheaded in all his well-doing. As I recall, Gene's essay, Monte Cristo, was about a day's fishing trip he and Doug Thayer made to the South Fork of the Ogden River, which drains a watershed capped by a peak named Monte Cristo, a term translating into English as something like Christ's Mount. Before Gene's advent into our group, it had been the custom for the featured writer to listen quietly for at least a half hour, hopefully learning thereby how his or her piece struck its readers. Gene, however, had little patience with this custom. On this particular evening, Gene intervened in our discussion soon after it had begun, asserting that we were failing to grasp its Christian import. I remonstrated, saying that the text offered no more than a pleasant narrative about a fishing excursion of two friends. I said that if Gene wished his reader to interpret the narrative as an allegory for a Christ-like relation between human beings, he needed to say so expressly. A suggestion Gene dismissed with an annoyed wave of his hand. This annoyed me in turn because it seemed to imply that a reader of this essay who needed an explicit statement was something less than competent. Later in the evening, returned to Ogden, I vented my spleen in my diary by derisively calling Gene the great Christian. Then, even as I prepared to write the next sentence, I repented of my petulance and admitted that despite his inability to listen to how others were interpreting his sentences, Gene was indeed the great Christian, certainly the greatest I have known. As the numerous friends who have stepped forward to express their grief and appreciation attest, he is the Lowell Benyon of his generation. I expressed the essence of Gene's saintliness in my diary with these sentences. Gene lives, eats, breathes the commandment to love one another. He suffers over conflict of all kinds, from war to backbiting. Gene was an activist in good causes. I confess that I was only half aware of these over the years because he never talked about them in my presence. It has been the outpouring of appreciation for Gene during this year since his death that has instructed me how widely he engaged in and recruited others to engage in a variety of charitable campaigns and protests against war and weaponry. The quality of Gene's saintliness that I knew most intimately was his profound, instinctive, unyielding belief in the good to be found in human beings. It was a quality I felt simply by being in his presence, because I could discern that he was applying it to me. The Christ of the Apocalypse, astride a white horse and attired in a vesture dipped in blood, the Christ who judges and makes war, was not Gene's Christ. Gene's Christ told an adulteress to go her way and sin no more. As I finished writing in my diary on that March night in 1982, I realized how far removed I was from the commandment that we loved one another. So I wrote that in Gene's presence, I appreciate freshly the sham of my intimacy with so many Mormons. I rarely think of Christ. I am a hardened naturalist. I have referred to myself as a backslider over and over in the purlieus of liberal Mormonism. It was, however, a term Gene refused to concede to me. He wouldn't accept that I was a sham Christian. The mere fact that he spoke with me so often, so easily and congenially, with such open acceptance, testified as to the worth he discerned in me. Those of you who were present at the memorial service held a year ago in the Provo Tabernacle will perhaps recall that at the conclusion of my remarks, I said that the most important thing about Gene for me was that he made me feel more like a true Mormon. He was, I said, among the foremost who salvaged me for Mormonism. In his presence, I felt my inadequacies diminished and my qualities enhanced. God be thanked for the life and influence of Gene England. Thank you.
Eugene England began with the spiritual and the moral, and then applied his mind and his activism in their service. For example, he was standing in the Vatican audience when the new Polish Pope, John Paul II, was shot. The would-be assassin's bullet whizzed by his ear, and Gene felt a spiritual witness that God was going to work through this religious leader. Gene then helped organize Food for Poland to help the embattled Polish labor union Solidarity in its resistance to the Soviets. I met Gene during this campaign. I was the editor of BYU's independent student newspaper, the Seventh East Press, and while delivering papers one day to faculty members, Gene recruited me to the cause of helping the Poles survive that winter. And I did what I could to publicize Food for Poland. He also convinced Sunstone editor Peggy Fletcher to run advertisements and news stories. And that helping Gene in Food for Poland brought a lot of strong criticism from other faculty in political science and Eastern European languages. Gene was naive, they said. They were sympathetic with his motives, but he just didn't understand the situation. His acts were heroic, but they wouldn't make a difference. The Poles didn't need our food, they said. They needed different kinds of support. The arguments of those scholars struck me, a young student, as quite valid. But what impressed me most was that while they were pontificating in their ivory towers, they were doing nothing. And Gene was acting on his beliefs and thoughts. Gene felt, and then he thought, and then he acted. Technically, Gene wasn't a baby boomer, but the issues of the 1960s became his issues, especially racism and war. And his very Mormon manner was modeled A very Mormon manner toward them was modeled by his mentor and Mormonism's brightest mind, Lowell Binion. After the Food for Poland winter, I helped organize BYU's first Peace Week, and Gene was one of the first to volunteer to speak. In his talk, Can Nations Love Their Enemies?, he showed how, in contrast to the individual general authority statements, that all of the LDS First Presidency statements on war and peace were very pacifist and in sync with Scripture. at least as he interpreted Scripture. That talk had a lasting impact on me. By that summer, Gene was giving the talk at Sunstone. I was then working at Sunstone under Peggy Fletcher, who asked me to chair the session. The respondent was a non-Mormon political science professor from the U, and he politely disagreed with Gene's perceptions of U.S. foreign policy. He argued that nations could not be self-sacrificing like the people in the Book of Mormon, that nations had to act in their self-interest, otherwise those leaders would soon be booted out, even in the most totalitarian countries. Nations have to act in self-interest. Having just read Henry Kissinger's memoirs, I realized that Gene really was naive in his understanding of politics and nations. And over the years, I had many conversations with him about that. But true to his beliefs, he never changed his mind. I was interested in exploring how to apply the Christian principles that Gene valued, given how humans act in society and in nations. Gene encouraged that enterprise, but it was not his passion. He was more of a prophet, and he was interested in holding up the principles that he knew were true and calling us to reform. But he didn't really get that interested in exploring the nuts and bolts of how that works in terms of, like, nations and stuff. That talk, however, was a threshold for Gene and Sunstone. By the fall, he had decided to publish it in the magazine. He ignored his respondents' points completely, and he revised the title that was a question into an affirmation. It now became, "Nations can love their enemies." I don't know the details, but his decision to publish was a wrenching one for him. Apparently, he had made some promise about something when he agreed to come to BYU, and he was worried that publishing the Sunstone would break that promise. He tried to contact relevant general authorities, and then, through an act of interpretation, he decided to go ahead, which was something he was transparently craving to do in any event. After that talk was published, his participation in Sunstone, in one form or another, was as regular as his heartbeat. Sunstone's then-managing editor, Susan Staker, outlined his talk and noted its structural rambling ways and rearranged the paragraphs into a more logical order and tightened his rambling sentences and then pulled her hair out when he rejected all of her improvements. Gene didn't take editing well, and he needed editing. He wrote competently and often gracefully and certainly poignantly, and his ideas were passionate. But he wrote long sentences. But having seen Susan's frustration, I never undertook a major editing of Gene. It was a worthless enterprise. But I ruthlessly cut his labyrinth sentences into 2 or 3 or, not rarely, 4 separate sentences, turning every semicolon into a period, you know? With each article, we joked about his long sentences, and he acknowledged that they were too long and needed to be cut. But he never, ever wrote short sentences, you know? And not only did his style not change, with age, and especially the advent of the computer, Gene's papers got longer and longer and longer. And we joked about how easy it was, and not really necessary, to add everything he thought and everything he found. Again, he acknowledged the point. But he never changed. You know, the papers just grew and grew. And then, in order to have a respondent at a symposium session, we had to put him in a 90-minute session for a single paper. He and Mike Quinn were the only two people who ever got 90-minute sessions for single papers. When Tina Brown took over editing The New Yorker and slashed the lengths of the magazine's articles, we talked about that, and I told him how the directions of magazines were going to shorter articles and shorter pieces because busy readers didn't read long articles anymore. I said, "Gene, if you really want to be read by more people, write shorter column-length articles, or even short things like letters to the editor. They're the things that get read a lot." And he said, I know, that's what we need to do. And he tried writing a few shorter pieces, but his heart just wasn't in it. Long pieces for him. He tried one or two, but it wasn't in him. King Benjamin says that leaders should be easy to be entreated, and Gene was easy to petition. He believed in Joseph Smith's aphorism that by proving contraries, truth is made manifest. And he distilled that philosophy into the word dialogue. And he practiced it. One always felt love and regard in conversation with him. He was easy to be entreated, and regardless of whether he accepted your advice or not. if Jean swam against the current in the length of articles, he led the pack in pithy titles. That accurately distilled his premise. Often pithy titles have really nothing to do with the paper, you know. When people complained to me that their symposium sessions were only attended by a few people, I often had to tell them that was because they had boring titles. And I pointed to Jean as a model. It always surprised me how few people followed his example. And those who tried usually failed. His success at distilling those titles really showed his genius and his activism, his intuitive sense for publicity. Consider two titles: Why the Church is as True as the Gospel, or Why Utah Mormons Should Become Democrats. They provoked you into thinking, let alone you happen to have read the paper. Once, after a speech he had given at a Sunstone Scripture Lecture Series, I commented to him that while it was a powerful sermon, and there were plenty, but there were plenty of scriptures that supported just the opposite side that he was making. He replied that yes, he was aware of them, but that it was important to make his point, which he felt was true, and therefore he needed to ignore the other ones. It was then that I realized that Jean was more of a cost fighter and a soldier than a scholar. He was working more to make the world Christian than to dispassionately analyze it. In almost all his works, his agenda is transparent. Even if it made some of his colleagues moan on yet another speech on atonement in Shakespeare, but not everyone saw, you know. Atonement was important to him. He was finding it in Shakespeare, you know. Or that his paper on the rhetorical style of Brigham Young really said more about Jean England's philosophy of rhetoric than it did about Brigham Young's preaching. It was to his credit that he acknowledged his biases, something not all academics do. Later, when I read Lo Benyon's teachings, I discovered that Jean was really, once again, following his mentor. Lowell had taught that it was more important to teach the Jesus who he knew, who was all-loving and all-caring, than to give credit to certain scriptures that taught him as a vengeful God. And Jean adopted that philosophy in his sermons. When Brigham Young was asked why he just didn't excommunicate the frustrating maverick apostle Orson Pratt, Brigham Young replied, "Well, because if you cut him up into 1,000 pieces, each one would scream, 'Mormonism is true!'" The same could be said about Jean. Early on, he had some formative spiritual experiences that cemented him to the Restoration. And interestingly, his unquestioning commitment allowed him the freedom to explore our understandings and practices of the Restoration without feeling threatened. It always surprised him and saddened the rest of us when his open exploration threatened others and made them suspect his motives and even his testimony. Rooted in the morality of the 60s, his views on race and war were clear and unambiguous, but not so with the social topics that followed the 60s. Sexism was easy for him, too, but what about polygamy? Well, believing that Joseph Smith was prophetic was a must for him, but he detested the inequality in the polygamous relationship, so he creatively concluded that Joseph's revolution was an inspired but temporary practice, you know. And gosh darn it, his ideas kept evolving. I'm not really sure if he ended up believing that Nephi committed knowing murder or not when he slew Laban. You know, he kept bouncing back around on that one. And when it came to homosexuality, well, Jean definitely died before he'd sorted that one out. A few years ago, he spoke at the annual conference of Mormon gays. In that speech, he traced his changing views, starting with his view that homosexuality was gays crossed to bear and celibacy. He stated how he had changed that view, and then he listed other values that he had in struggling and juggling to try to come up with a theology, you know, love and intimacy and relationship and compassion and obedience. And it was quite a hodgepodge of ideas for people to follow in his talk. What they got was a rambling journey, which was Jean's compliment to them, as he was candid about his views and his struggles on the topic. But since most people didn't listen carefully, they either liked or hated his talk, depending upon which part they actually listened to. And those who dutifully tried to follow still didn't know what to make of all the poorly connected parts. But everyone heard his love and compassion, even if they were frustrated with what they thought he had said. Jean's love and regard won most people over. Richard Bushman may have rolled his eyes at Jean's history, and Bonarici marvels at how one so intelligent could never really understand how organizations work. But they loved Jean dearly and valued his creative contributions. For years as editor of Sunstone, I'd spend a day at BYU dropping in on faculty. Each time I visited Bert Wilson, Jean's department chair, Bert would clench his fist on the desk and pound his desk and say, "I told you, Jean, not to give that speech, or to write that letter, or to publish that article. I told him that they wouldn't see it the way he thought they would. I told him it would just cause trouble. But gosh darn him, he did it anyway. You know, and now I have a mess to clean up." You know, frustrated as Bert was, and Bert was an old childhood friend of Eugene, as he always called him, he loved Jean to the core and knew his heart and motives and did the best he could to organizationally save Jean. Jean was extraordinarily naive when it came to organizations, but he was one of the first to see the winds that were beginning to blow in the intellectual community. In the late 1980s, when he read the draft of BYU's 10-year accreditation self-study, he raised red flags about the phrase about religious institutions' right to limit faculty from speaking at Sunstone or publishing in Dialogue. His flippant response was, "Well then, let's speak at Dialogue and publish in Sunstone." But beyond that piece of humor, he could really not engage any of the other faculty in being really interested in that statement. Then came Dallin Oaks' talk on alternate voices in 1989, followed 2 years later by the statement on symposia by the first presidency in the Quorum of the Twelve. Jean recruited Ed Kimball, and together they authored a statement that simultaneously affirmed the commitment of their commitment to the statement and their commitment to speaking at Sunstone, and said how it was neither violated the other. Obviously, his creative and somewhat legalistic theology did not convince the brethren. But Jean was more than an activist. He was a peacemaker, and he never gave up attempting to build bridges through dialogue. In one conversation with a BYU administrator, in what Jean no doubt saw as a sacrificial act, he committed not to speak at Sunstone. It's too bad they didn't really hammer out the details, for Jean assumed that that meant not speaking at the Sunstone Symposium in Salt Lake City. And that was the year he spoke at every regional symposium. But he adamantly refused to not speak at the one in August because he had to keep his promise. But prompted by the self-study report, Jean's eyes were attuned to the encroachments on dialogue, and he found organizational hints of a secret committee whose name had been mentioned in some general authority memos that had become public. And at that symposium where Jean was going to remain silent, he sat in Levina Fielding Anderson's session where she chronicled instance after instance of ecclesiastical abuse. Jean became more and more incensed, and his sense of justice and morality was stirred, and he connected the dots from Levina's acts of abuse to that secret committee. And when it came time for the audience to comment, he stood up to speak. He mentioned the committee by name, the Committee to Strengthen the Members. And he explained how this group of nameless inquisitional bureaucrats had usurped the power of church leaders. And then Jean, who had promised not to speak at the conference, uttered the words that would be most quoted from that conference. "I accuse this committee of undermining the church." No doubt Jean had reasoned that he had really promised not to give a paper at the conference and that he had not broken his promise. Still, he was sad at his impulsive act. No doubt, too, BYU administrators and supervisors felt that Jean had broken his promise when he spoke at the first regional symposium, and the one at Salt Lake was just topping on the cake. Just as Jean had felt that he had not broken his earlier promise to President Kimball not to publish an article, and he thought the promise was now void when President Kimball had died. I'm sure the general authorities didn't see it that way, you know. Same thing with him coming to BYU and then speaking at Sunstone. Church leaders saw Jean as a promise breaker who took every opportunity to undermine them. And it is a great irony that Jean and his friends saw himself as one who sincerely tried to be a promise keeper and who was loyal and impressively obedient. Jean was also one of the most Christian people I knew. If he was true to his thoughts and writing style, he was also true to the Sermon on the Mount. No one repented faster or more sincerely than Jean. If you rebuked him for some acts of his, he'd confess and strive to do it no more and to eliminate all effects of that. He never would respond hard. He would take it and reform. This was true of his symposium outburst. A few days later, he learned that the secret committee was not comprised of faceless church bureaucrats, but it was a committee of apostles. And he repented. He rushed a letter to be published in the next issue of Sunstone, saying that he had learned more, and he recanted his comments and fully supported his leaders. He was genuine in this. But I'm sure it looked to the general authorities like simple hypocrisy and blatant opportunism. As the tension between Mormon intellectuals and the church grew, Gene struggled hard to spread oil to calm the waters. But his commitment to Mormonism was a commitment to proving contraries, which meant open discussion. And so he supported those liberals, so-called liberals, in the culture wars at BYU, including the movement to get BYU censored for not allowing free speech. Despite his efforts, the fights and the harm to good people and good causes deeply hurt him. He bore that pain and sadness publicly. He talked to everyone about it, and what could we do? The tax on him personally, however, he bore very privately. When the religion department refused to allow him to teach honors classes that gave religion credit, he almost told no one and continued to serve in the areas he could. When reports circulated that intense screening of new faculty applicants was in part to guarantee that BYU would hire, quote, no more Eugene Englands, he would only discuss it in terms of injustice to others, never to himself. When a chair of Sunstone's board told him that his symposium address on the Weeping God of Mormonism was determined by the general authorities to be the most heretical session of that symposium, it broke his heart. I could see that it hurt him a lot, but he never talked about it. Then when a member of the board told him that he shouldn't be the chair of Sunstone because that would offend the brethren and hurt their relationship with him, Gene accepted that judgment very quietly. Gene lamented the fragmenting of the Mormon intellectual community and tried to keep his contacts and friendship with everyone involved, no matter how far apart they were going. But the fragmenting saddened him deeply. He confided his bewilderment at how many of his brightest BYU students who had an interest in Mormon studies had left Mormonism. And he had fleeting doubts about the underlying premises of the whole Mormon intellectual project. You know, why hadn't their core spiritual experiences bonded them to Mormonism as his had? It is to Gene's credit that he honestly pondered these questions. It is also to his credit that he continued to maintain his support for individuals and institutions that fostered that process while he pondered these things. Without exception, those who Gene lamented about their journey from Mormonism, no matter what they feel about Mormonism, including incredibly hostile feelings to a person, they all love Gene England and feel a deep friendship with him. Gene may have not known how to apply Christian principles in organizations or nations, but he knew how to live them in his own life. I well recall the first time Gene said to me, "How are you, my friend?" What an honor and gift to be called Gene England's friend, and one that he bestowed as generously on people as the Father sends his Son to shine on us all. I've often wondered what kind of person Jesus was, because he was a person who held a high moral standard and preached it. Yet, the people who were the disrespected people of society, the whores, the taxpayers, the publicans, the inactives, liked being around Jesus. They liked his company. You know, and it's hard to imagine many of the people, it's hard to imagine lots of the people who aren't following the line in our church enjoying the company of many of our general authorities. But Gene was a person. If I have to think of a person who could combine both of those attributes of holding a high moral standard and yet being a person with whom company you enjoy while he's holding the standards, Gene England is the best example I can think of that value. And that's the best compliment I can pay to him. In my trials during my last few years at Sunstone, Gene continually told me how much he loved me, and that meant a lot to me. Although at the time I remember thinking, responding in my mind with that popular statement, love is not enough, you know, to solve these problems. You know, that may be true of so many issues that he's assailed, that love is not enough. But now that he's gone, I've thought of how, yes, in one sense, love may not be enough, but love is also not only all we have, but ultimately all there is. And Jean knew that and followed that. A few weeks ago, after I was invited to be on this panel, I had a dream where Jean and I were sitting and talking. And he told me of this great idea to raise money for Sunstone. He said that for my 50th birthday, I should right now send out a letter to all Sunstone supporters and request that instead of sending me a gift, they should give it to me now. But not to me, but to Sunstone. And when I pointed out to him that my 50th was still a few years away, and that my birthday's in February, not in the summer, and that almost all of the people who ever thought of giving me a birthday, of all those people who were donors to Sunstone, none of them ever thought about giving me a birthday gift. He just smiled, acknowledged those points, and said that the idea was sound nonetheless. I jokingly told him that this was a perfect example of his idealism and naivete, kind of comment I would have made to him in person. And he willingly conceded that, yes, they were both points were right, but he wanted to proceed nonetheless. In the exchange, I felt nothing but warm love. And Jean seemed so much alive. It was very sad to wake up and to realize that he's gone. And it's such a loss to the Mormon intellectual community because no other person was a glue that held so many disparate parts together as did Jean England by his love and his passion for life and thought and making this world better. And that's what Mormonism is.
I've always felt like one of the young people in Jean's life, but as I was thinking about the remarks I might make today, I thought of something I wanted to begin with. It was 24 years ago this summer that I received in the mail this packet of information. My twin brother Greg and I were about to go to BYU, begin our freshman year. We were 17, and we were going to be in Jean's first honors colloquium. And I didn't know who Jean England was at the time. I just knew I was going to BYU and I was going to be in the honors program. My older brother had done it the year before. And my dad looked at the materials and he stopped at one point and said, Jean England is going to be your teacher. And this meant nothing to us at that point. We may have heard his name in our family, but I didn't really have any sense at all of what that would be. And he just kind of shook his head and said, that will be a memorable, significant experience for you. I remember walking into the Mountain View Chapel, just below campus, for that first colloquium. It was unreasonably an 8-hour class, which means that it dominated our lives for the whole year. And the first day, there we were, young 17-year-olds, sitting there waiting with our fellow students for Jean to arrive. And I remember very well, in my mind's eye, he seemed to literally prance into the room. He had a pair of white shoes, as I recall, and he had a lot of energy, and he began to speak. And that day we went home, and both Greg and I felt like we had the hell scared out of us. I feel like I'm someone who was drawn, as so many have been, by Jean's big ideas and big thoughts. And yet, in the years that I've known him, what has come to mean the most to me, and I think what has held my bond with him, are small things. Greg mentioned something that I feel as well when I was speaking to him on the phone this morning. We were talking about this, and he said Jean was a Christian with a small c. I think that's true. In the colloquium we had with Jean, I wanted to say a few things about this. I really tried to write this as a paper and could not succeed, and so I'm going to move through some areas that have connection for me, and I'll try and bridge them for you. Again, we were young, and we followed him around. I remember feeling like Jean was speaking the word of God, that he had answers to everything. He had such a powerful and charismatic presentation. That class, again, being his first colloquium, we felt like guinea pigs. And I think that his ideas and his teachings, which, again, he summarized in the title of that course, Learning How to Learn, has pretty much became the foundation for mine, for many other people's way of thinking. His influence on my mind and the shape of my thinking is really immeasurable. And I think that his embrace of contradictory ideas, his embrace of paradox, which at times became, most of the time was something we admired, sometimes became infuriating to us, at other times became comical as a way to deal with the anger we felt about how much he could contain and how much he encouraged us to do that. I remember once striding across campus with him, and that's, if you walked with him, you walked fast. I remember in great frustration asking him why he had assigned so much reading. It was a really just an unreasonable amount of reading, and I couldn't keep up with it, and I knew I was studying much harder than I'd ever studied in high school, which maybe isn't saying that much, but I was really, really working hard to stay up. I'm a relatively smart guy, and it was impossible. I could not keep up with the reading, and I know that others in that class felt the same way. I remember asking him about that, and I'm sure I asked it with a lot of frustration sort of bleeding out into my expression and my delivery, and he did something that he often did, which will maybe sound callous, but often in moments when I would express my greatest frustration towards him and with him, he would laugh. And it wasn't a mocking laugh, but it was sort of a laugh of resignation. A couple weeks later, he came up to me and he said, "You know that conversation we had about too much work? I just want you to understand that I know it's too much work." And I realized that he, I think, wanted us to try and make priorities, and he wanted to put us in a situation where we would have to choose and decide what was most important to us, and that he also, with that, accepted that we may choose things other than what he was giving us, something that I slowly learned to do with Gene. I remember during that colloquium, he wanted us all to have an experience with reading Thoreau's Walden that was beyond just a classroom experience, and he connected it to a wilderness trek. I remember I met Becky, one of his daughters, on that. She was, I think, just 13. That was another experience where a lot of us felt great frustration. The things we did, the miles we walked without food, again, I'm sort of trying to characterize him as someone early in my experience with him, he became larger than life, impossible to match in terms of his accomplishments and ability to take things on, and yet we couldn't not follow him. Greg said something, and I just want to say it because it makes me laugh and it also seems relevant. He said that Gene was to his intellectual development what Bob Dylan was to popular music in the latter part of the 20th century. And you can read that a lot of ways, mostly positive. So, but as a teacher, I think Gene clearly has had a huge influence on a lot of people, and I'm one of those people. He's one of the few great mentors in my life. To my happy surprise, the others are all here today. And I will always be grateful to him for that. I think of him as a midwife to many people's intellectual birth. As has been said, it's been a year now since Gene died, and I remember very well the bruised and bruising phone call I received from my dad. And over the last year, like I'm sure many others, I've wondered and mourned and grieved and laughed and smiled and felt mostly a deep, deep, sad longing as I've remembered him. I'm really honored to be able to talk a little about him today. I wasn't able to be at his memorial services, and I've struggled really all year at different times in thinking about what I feel and think in more complex ways about Gene, his life, and his death. I have to confess something. I've weighed whether or not I should, but I think that I should be honest because my relationship with Gene, I valued it because I felt like I always could be honest. I've resisted for much time saying anything. There have been various occasions where I could have talked to someone or mentioned something or tried to put something in writing, and I haven't done that. And it's bothered me that I haven't, and I've wondered about that, and I'm not entirely clear about that, but I think if I'm most honest, it's partly because Gene was so important to so many people, he influenced so many people, that I wanted to jealously hang on to the thing that I had with him, and by articulating it, I would lose it somehow. When I was in Madrid in January doing some research, I went for a break to see a re-release at a theater of the Beatles' Hard Day's Night. And for some reason, after the movie, I came out thinking two things, one and then the other, in a rather startling succession. The first was just the Beatles. They got away with so much. They were such clueless, happy fellows. And yet they're still popular. And, there are critics who are sick of the Beatles, and I'm never sick of the Beatles. And I found myself thinking, you know why I'm never sick of the Beatles? Do you know why they sort of hang on that way, among other things? It's because they were able to say I love you in more ways than anyone else with it remaining fresh. The early songs, their later songs, there's something about saying I love you. And suddenly I began thinking about Gene and thought, this is something that I think about Gene. The idealism, the many ways to say I love you, something that you'd think would get stale but seems to come with new sort of structure and impact, the disillusionment, somehow that connected for me. And the other night when, and I'm not sure who put together the presentation, I assume members of the family, for the first time I saw this slideshow, noted that two of the songs were Beatles songs, When I'm 64 and the last Let It Be. I felt somehow confirmed in my thinking. But I think with the 60s references, it makes sense. I think Gene was open in a way that very few people I've known are, and I think his openness led him to many wonderful and many difficult things. Gene was a figure of love, as many have said, and I think I've tried to think about what that means different from other people who are also figures of love in my life, and I think Gene's openness probably characterizes his type of love as much as anything else. I don't think that makes him easy to get along with, necessarily, or easy to deal with all the time, but I think it makes him rare in being so open to things. I mentioned his ideas. He was open to ways of thinking about Mormonism and things not Mormon that were very influential on me. His essay on the Atonement is still the only paradigm of the Atonement that makes much sense to me, and it more than makes sense. It's something that has always been really important to me. I've always been baffled at the responses that many people in the church, especially leaders, have had towards Gene. I know that sounds like a naive thing, and maybe being naive about that is some way of trying to reach out to Gene, because I think that was something he struggled with much of his life. I feel like his great struggle late in life was his surprise at the malice other people could have towards him. He was one of the few really greatest Mormons I've ever known, and there were times when my willingness to think about and consider Mormonism, and I'm one of the people who has drifted away from Mormonism, but Gene was always one of the reasons why I couldn't stop thinking about it and stop taking it seriously. And I think that was heartbreaking. It was a little bit heartbreaking for me to watch, and I'm sure it was consumingly heartbreaking for him to experience. And I think that's a kind of ingenuousness that is very unusual, and he clung to. I sensed a kind of maturing later in his life. I think there was always an arrogance to Gene, because he's so smart, and he could do things so well, and he could take on so much. And I think it probably was always very hard for him to accept that the burdens he placed on himself and seemed to enjoy were not burdens that always worked with other people, and that sometimes would be misunderstood and misinterpreted. When I was on my mission, Brother Brigham, he sent me a copy. It was one of the few books that really felt like it was an honest inquiry into something. And I'm not comparing it to the scriptures. I'm just saying the kind of books that I was encouraged to read other than the scriptures didn't help me very much, but Brother Brigham did. And I feel like, whereas many of us, myself included, have paid lip service in different ways to Brigham Young or Joseph Smith, Gene really read and thought about them. And even though he clearly filtered their ideas into his own paradigms, he's really struggled with their ideas. And so I felt like that was an honest inquiry for him. One of the most, I think, valuable legacies that I have from Gene is that, although I've never understood why people in the church have sometimes been uncomfortable with him, I've also started to understand why his response was seldom anger. His sense of resignation and that his energies were better applied to things that mattered more to him is a really easy lesson to identify and an excruciatingly hard lesson to learn and actually practice in your life. I'm an angry person in many ways, and Gene's ability to use his anger for good things is one of those things that, one of those ideals about him that I've not let go of, and while I don't ever really expect to be able to do it as well as he did, it's something I admire and would like to do better, and I think about that. Gene's openness let him get along with people of really different persuasions. I will just use as kind of a metaphor, a figure, my own family, where I realized kind of remarkably, he had good relationships with everyone in my family, although on very different terms, from the kind of intense and probably pathological relationship that my twin brother Greg and I had with him as students in many classes and graduate assistants in London, and a lot of these sort of intellectual men. Other siblings who had different kinds of relationships with him, members of my family who were not interested in the big ideas or the intellectual things, he still had very good relationships with them. And I always felt that he was very good at being open to people that way. My dad mentioned to me a few months ago that I might be interested in being on this panel, and then I was finally asked. I at first thought, I'm not sure why I would be a person to be on this panel. since many of the things that seem to have bound Gene to other people in his life have, in the last 15 years, at least in explicit ways, seem to fade away in my life. But I think about the last times I've seen Gene, 2 years ago at Sunstone, a couple of years before that, and we've had long conversations, and I had the experience that Albert mentioned. It is a profound experience when he would come up to me and say, "Hello, friend," or "Hello, old friend," or "There's a familiar face." And I always felt very known and understood. And the other night when his face came up on the screen, it really hit me hard because his face conveyed a lot. His was a face of youth, of purity, of love. He was a boy, a good, beautiful boy, and he seemed to always have that face. I've always admired Gene for his tolerance, and I've seen tolerance as perhaps at the top of the pyramid of virtues in my life. The other day, just 2 days ago at Sunstone, I went to a discussion with James Fowler, and we talked about a number of things, but one thing he mentioned stuck with me. He said, "The antidote to shame is grace." And I think maybe I've made a turn in my thinking, and I think that maybe one of the greatest things that Gene could offer, fleetingly at times, but still offer, was something beyond grace. Excuse me, something beyond tolerance, and that would be grace. Some of you have heard about this experience, but I'll just sort of close with it. When I was in London with Gene as a graduate student, assistant for the London program, and I made more errors than I care to admit and was struggling with all kinds of things, I remember a conversation late one night with Gene about the church. I remember wanting, when we had this conversation, to push, and really get to honestly what I felt about it and how it distinguished me from him. That was important to me, I remember. And we talked about it, and I said, "Look, I think the difference between us is that I don't love the church in the way that you do. I don't love being around Mormons the way that you do. I don't enjoy being with the community, and I know that you do. And this is very hard for me to admit, but it's something I've got to think about because it's just how I feel." And I remember he was very supportive and said, "Your path may be a different one, and it may not be in the church." I'm not trying to somehow use Gene as someone who's happy to get people out of the church. I'm trying to talk about how Gene was able to offer something that maybe is beyond tolerance. Tolerance for me means accepting people's differences, but it always carries with it a kind of desire to understand their differences, maybe not in a condescending way, but in a way that sort of encircles them. It doesn't let them go. And I feel that grace, in some ways, unmerited, undeserved, given freely, is about accepting and supporting people in doing things that are fundamentally, by definition, beyond your understanding, which means often beyond your happiness for them or what they're doing. And I feel that Gene was able to offer that to me. So I think he, in some ways, is a figure of love, but also a figure of grace. Gene's greatest strengths were often his greatest burdens. He, as I've said, assumed that all were as curious and as tolerant as he was. Gene was always fair. I think he was more than fair in the face of criticism. And I think when people were unhappy with him and criticized him, his response and his way of dealing with others always made him stand very large and very tall. In the end, I think his most courageous choice in life was to not be cynical. And I think cynicism is not just an easily defined thing. It's very, very subtle. And it's ultimately not taking things seriously, especially those things that threaten us or make us unhappy or that make us angry. And I think he was able to not be cynical to a degree that is unrivaled in my experience. There's much about Gene's life, his private life, his life with his family that I have no idea about. I can't speak to. But as one who's been touched at times, transformed by his generosity, I can thank him for his grace.
If some of you would like to come up and share experiences, say something, why don't you come to the pulpit and let's try and keep it relevant. We have about a half hour, about 35 minutes, and keep it relatively brief, but we'd like to have you come up and do that. Say your name when you do it, if you would, please.
My name is Sharon Larson. I met Gene in the 60s when I was an undergraduate at Cal State Hayward. I was one of those people who was, as the gal says, in my big fat Greek wedding. I was past my sell-by date. At any rate, I didn't know anything about Gene except that he was a really great teacher. I didn't enjoy every class I took, but I would come home and tell my family how much I really enjoyed the classes I was taking with Gene. And somewhere in there, someone introduced me to dialogue. And I opened it and I read it, and my first thought was, oh, that's why. And I talked to him often about dialogue and after that and about the church. And I can really say that I'm one of the people who may still be in the church because of Gene. And it may be that he convinced me of the importance of community and the importance of not being able to, not having to live with everything. That I could still be part of the church and not believe that everything about it was wonderful. And I appreciate this greatly. I think that not only have I stayed, my husband has stayed, and a majority of our children have stayed. And I'm grateful to him and always will be able to be grateful that I'm able to have this as a part. Of course, as I grow older, I grow more conservative, and lots fewer things bother me. Except I'll tell you one thing that bothered me as I grow older, and that's that Gene never did. That was the most annoying thing to me. I would see him year after year, grayer and grayer, and he'd still look just the same as he had looked when I knew him in the 60s. Just not fair. But I appreciate so many things about him, and especially the chance I had to know him. And I just want to leave this with you.
I just want to say something. My name is Renee Carlson. I used to be Renee Pyatt, and Charlotte and I were little girls together. We lived very close to each other, and our daddies were chiropractors, and so we had a lot in common. But I knew Gene when he was young and dating Charlotte, and actually I went out on a few dates with him before he dated Charlotte. It's okay, Charlotte, you know that. But when I met my husband, Jack, Charlotte and Gene and Jack and I, we used to go out to the Avalon Ballroom, and we would whirl around. Gene was a great dancer, you know, just that woo, woo, and, you know, you'd go all around the room. Jack was a great dancer, too. And we'd all go out there, and we'd have such a great time. And, you know, it was wonderful. And Charlotte and Gene married about 2 months before Jack and I got married. Of course, they left and went to Samoa, and we stayed. But I've known Charlotte and Gene all my life. And when I heard that Gene, you know, had a tumor and was, you know, in a bad way, I was just shot down. Because Charlotte and Gene are my perennial youth. And we even had children at the same time. I had one more than they did. But, you know, I had to outdo you a little bit. But I wasn't able to get back to the funeral. And I just, you know, want to tell everybody that Gene England and Charlotte, because they're a team, they've always been a team, were some of the dearest friends, most loyal, most honest, most trustworthy, most sterling people that I've ever known. And Jack ran for the U.S. Senate in 76, and that's a bruising experience. And Charlotte and Gene stood by us and had little meetings at their house and passed out placards and all the stuff. And we've all been through a lot together. But I told Gene this morning I want her to come back to the East Coast and walk along the beach, because I lost Jack 10 years ago. And it takes a lot out of you. And it's really important to renew yourself, renew your love of life, and renew all the things that you know are beautiful, the nature and your relationships and everything. And that life is going to go on. And that the wonderful thing about it all are the great memories. Thinking of the dancing, thinking of the wonderful times we've all had together, and the love which has been brought out here, and the sharing of all that we've enjoyed. And I just want to tell Charlotte that you can live on a lot of that, and you can create more memories, and you have your great family, and I have a great family, and there's a life after this. Thank you.
My name is Bill Bradshaw. I grew up in Salt Lake City in the Wasatch Ward on Roosevelt Avenue, and 15th East was the borderline between our ward and the Colonial Hills ward. And I knew the Hawkins family a little bit. Dorothy B. and I were classmates at UMass School. And I knew about the England family only sort of remotely, especially that Gene's father was an important church leader in the Hillside Stake. And the interesting relationship that I have here is that my father and Gene's father were very close friends. And for many years worked together on Temple Square. And Gene and I sort of learned to know each other because our dads were very close and similar men in that they were strong-willed, somewhat mavericks, but extraordinarily devoted to the church. And often when I had a chance to talk to Gene, it was we sort of knew each other because we knew the devotion of our fathers to important things, and somehow this was a connection that was very important. I couldn't hope to improve on the well-articulated reminiscences that we've heard today, but I add just this small part of something like a brotherly relationship that I felt that had its connections through families and the church, and there was a sense of continuity and something of eternity in all of this that I'm really grateful for.
My name is Tom Parks. I first met Gene England at the University of Utah when he came and spoke at one of our sacrament services, and I wondered, who is this high school kid? Until he opened his mouth, and it removed all doubt as to who was the more advanced. Actually, he was 2 years older than I, having gone on a mission and just returned with Charlotte, and I hadn't. We shared classes at the Institute. We shared classes in ROTC. And 2 years after graduation, I flew a broken-down F-100 into George Air Force Base. It had broken right after takeoff, and I knew once I got it on the ground it wasn't going to continue any farther. But so we got it on the ground okay, walked into the base operations, and there's a weatherman in uniform, Gene England. He recognized me immediately. It was a bear hug and a how are you, and so forth, and we hadn't seen each other for 2 years and since our classes together at the U. And that's the way it's been over the years. After the Englands left the Air Force and went to Stanford, and I could fly into Navy Moffett Field there and go visit them, and it was always a reunion, the same bear hug, the same how are you, and come to our home and shared meals and fellowship, and even though he was very busy in the bishopric. And maybe I've not heard anybody in any of the tributes say anything about this experience. I'd just like to share it as the type of a contribution that Gene was always making. In Victorville, he was teaching early morning seminary and teaching mutual for the young people, always very involved with the young people. And then at Stanford, of course, he was a counselor in a bishopric and teaching part-time at the Institute of Religion. I recall on one of my visits there, he was called to the phone, and I was left in the library to rummage around and for a few minutes and found some of these beautiful coffee table type art books. I opened it up, full of autographs and signatures and tributes from students that he had taught at the institute there at Stanford. And then I heard the story, I guess, I don't recall, I believe he told me the story about how they had become alarmed as a bishopric with the large number of the fallout of students, freshmen, the brightest LDS students just coming to Stanford and becoming totally inactive in their first year, and how they researched to find what the cause of that problem was. And I guess they finally decided it was this freshman course in Western civilization that just destroyed their faith and their testimonies in the gospel. And so the solution that they came up with, as I recall, was that Gene would teach a class at the Institute using the same textbook that the university used, but go into it in deeper modes and explain the presuppositions, the assumptions, the data behind the information in those textbooks. And some of the signatures in those books were tributes to him for having saved many testimonies. And I hope that that's been the truth throughout his life. I know every time I would visit him like that and then leave, his final parting comment was always, "The gospel is true." And that was his testimony to his dying day. And I appreciate him for it and for all the meaning he brought into my life. Like Levi Peterson, I struggled with Monte Cristo and talked to him about that later. But at 2 a.m., after having finished that essay, at 2 a.m. in the middle of the night, the light came on and I knew what he was trying to say. But it hadn't been easy, and that's the way with a lot of his writings. So I pay tribute to him for all of his writings and for his continuing the legacy of Lowell Bunyan and T. Edgar Lyon, who are our mentors. And I just am glad to see that somebody like Gene England was able to take that heritage and magnify it far better than I. Thank you, Gene. Thank you, Charlotte.
I was one of those freshmen at Stanford who had the privilege of showing up. I think we didn't really use the same text by the time I got there as was being used in the Western Civ class, but I showed up from I was always a questioning person. I'd come from Southern California, and now I was in this expanding environment of Northern California and the university and new ideas and all that kind of stuff, and it was such a joy and such a reassurance and such a blessing to have someone like Gene, who was more questioning than I was, who had thought of any question I was ever likely to think of, and who trusted his mind more than I trusted mine, and who believed in the church, and who was faithful to it, and who, I wouldn't automatically agree with everything he said, but I knew there was a commitment there, and just a couple of little snapshots. Unlike the previous speaker, Gene didn't say at the end of every class, "The church is true." In fact, he hardly ever said that. But you got the feeling that Gene would never say anything to you that he didn't believe. That he was so honest in his way of teaching. He wasn't interested in indoctrinating you. He was interested in teaching you what he actually knew. And toward the end of the year, we had a discussion, and this is just an indication of what he meant to us, where, okay, you guys, anything you want to talk about. And, of course, everybody wanted to know, would you give us whatever your testimony is? We want to know, do you believe this stuff? at the core of it. And we want to know what a testimony is to you and what you believe. I don't have either the eloquence or the good memory to tell you exactly what he said, but he talked about early experiences in his life, and he talked about the firmness of his conviction, and you knew that he wasn't lying to you, okay, whatever. And so we trusted him, and he taught me, just through his writings, a level of trust in my own experience of the Spirit and my own experience of my mind and the way those things fit together that, just to read just to read from somebody who was faithful, the idea that you didn't have to accept, well, you could think about Paul and what his experiences were and how his writings grew out of his experiences. I don't know, I was very naive at the time, and I sort of looked at the scriptures, you know, you got to either accept exactly what it says or reject it all, and I was not going to be able to accept it all, you know, word for word, and to realize that these things were coming from somewhere, and that it was okay to think that way, and it was okay to use your mind and be reasonable about things, was a huge blessing in my life. And I just want to say one other thing, which was I wrote an essay right back when I was right back from my mission, a really enthusiastic essay about how Mormonism was well equipped to deal with this problem of evil that other religions had trouble with. And, you know, after it, I felt good about the essay, and it was published in Century 2 or whatever it was called. It was like 10 times as long as it was. I shared with Gene the need to put everything into an article, and it was Mormonism, a problem of evil, and it was like took up half the magazine, but they couldn't cut it because there was too much. I don't know. They didn't have enough articles. But a year later, he was back at Stanford, and he was so enthusiastic about this article, and he was, you know, by that time, I was almost embarrassed by it because it was so pro-Mormon, and it was so, it was sort of like, you know, I felt I had to repent and pick a problem later that was harder for Mormonism, like the problem of morality, which we have a hard time, you know, how do you justify moral obligation within Mormon theology, which is actually a hard problem theologically. But Gene was so enthusiastic, and so it was. He taught me to trust myself, and he believed in us, and in all of our ability, if we have the right hearts and everything to really contribute. And I have so much that it's just a testimony. I'm really thankful for his influence.
I feel compelled to just respond to all that's been said today. Before I get too much feeling like I'm not worthy of this guy. Levi knows. Bert knows. Doug Thayer knows. But he's still getting a 90-minute session. It just seems like he gets the last word every time. So I've got to have the last word. There are just some things that were set up here. Talking about the backslider first. When he was reading the book, and he'd read it in bed at night, and I'd be reading something, he'd be reading something, pretty soon the bed would just be shaking, just be laughing so hard. And I'd say, you know, what is so funny? He said, oh, you just have to read it. You just have to read it. I said, well, I want to know. I think we better read this together. And he said, oh, no, I don't think I'll read it. And he was just relishing this experience. And it was just... And of course, it wasn't until I read it later that I knew what he was going through. But he just had such a love for life in every way that all these characters he knew, he related to, because Levi did such a wonderful job of creating them and making them come alive. But I was so glad when he finished reading that book. It was just this, you know, laughing and not knowing what it was about. So until I finally got to find out. The Food for Poland thing, it was a most interesting experience. And it all started one Sunday afternoon when we were back from the study abroad. And we were sitting around the table, our family, and, you know, we're just talking all the time and kind of to figuring out, you know, what could we do about this situation in Poland. And so we talked about it, and of course then Gene was able to just go ahead and do something with it. And all I can say is thank you for naivete. I just, you know, if if it wasn't for that, what would we do? We'd be so reasonable, and we'd do all the right things, and we'd never explore, and we'd never adventure out into these and have these great things happen that can only happen if we stop fussing over what we shouldn't do. It's true he didn't take editing well. He always gave me his papers to read before they were sent out, and you know, if you think it was long when you got it, you should have seen what I cut out. And then we'd argue over that a little bit, and I said, well, let Doug look at it, or let Bert look at it, or let Levi, let somebody else look at it, and it come back with the same comments that I had made. So I said, see, you know, there's something in this. So, but it was a great experience to do that because I became, you know, his work was never a separate thing from me in that sense that I think many writers or, you know, professionals in any sense, that they do their job and wives or families just aren't aware of really what's going on in their life, but it was very integrated. And especially the early days of dialogue, that it was really exciting because the papers, you know, we didn't have the setup that they have now, and nor was anyone paid, except the secretary. She did a horrendous job. But we were at Stanford, and so the manuscripts were coming to the house many of the times, and you know, we were reading them, and it was the energy and the thrill of it and seeing the response of the people and the expressions and the joy of the whole thing happening. And we just, you know, and then a few years later, after it had been going for a while, maybe a couple of years, and the rumors came back that Jean and I had left the church and started a polygamous cult and that all of our children had left the church. Of course, most of them hadn't been baptized by then, but other than that, you know. And I was so cut by this. I mean, I just could not believe it. I couldn't comprehend it. I couldn't understand it. And then as Jean was invited to speak around in the Bay Area to different groups to learn about dialogue and things, and he'd go, you know, we'd arrive to the meetings, and you could tell that a few people had read it, and the other people who hadn't read it, and they were just, you know, leery of this. And then he'd start, and his talks kind of went in phases. And there'd be the first one where he'd be introducing all these things out there, you know, for people to kind of struggle with, you know, questions or proposals or something. And then he'd get into the second phase, and he would be, and that would be just the really stirred up part. And I'd watch the audience, and I just wanted to, you know, stand up and say, everybody, stay calm. Wait until the third phase. You're going to love it. And then when you get all through, all these people would come up, and then it would be, I had no idea that you were like this. I had no idea that you believed. I didn't know. And then you'd find out they had never even read the book. And it was just such a revelation to me that people could judge so quickly and so readily and in so horrendously. And then all it took was to have time with him and to hear it, and then they felt his spirit, they felt him, and their anger, their suspicion, and all those things just fell away. It was so easy, and I never could understand why people couldn't take the time to do that so that those kinds of things could be erased. And as we are going through his papers now, trying to bring some order to them. And if you ever saw his desk, his office, you have an idea of what we're going through. He did have file cabinets, and he does have those. We have maybe half a dozen tall file cabinets we have yet to even start on, but these are just boxes of things were kind of thrown together when he made his very rapid move from BYU. And many of these are correspondence between him and some general authorities and administrative people. And my question, as was raised here, is why? The letters of apology that went out from him to them, certain responses were almost embarrassing from them. That he, you know, like, you know, it isn't necessary to, you know, to apologize anymore in public, Gene. Let's just keep this quiet. And it was such a dismissal that taking the time to sat down together, as he invited many to do, would have erased so much pain and so much anguish and question. And it wasn't necessary to have had happen. He looked at the goodness in people. He trusted them. He trusted them to have ideas, to think and be creative, and to believe in each other. That was the basis he worked on. And that's why he was able to care about people of all kinds, people who didn't agree with him, people who challenged him, and he wasn't afraid to take that on. He saw the good in people, even saw the best in Brigham Young. Oh my gosh. As I read some things he didn't put in the book, and I said, what about this? He said, well, yeah, that's true. That was part of Brigham. And I said, well, I think you've made him to a very nice, warm person. And he needs it. We all need that. So he was a good one for that. And I'll tell you about the polygamy. That came about. I couldn't abide the whole idea. And Gene had some pretty typical male attitudes about it at first. And I just said, you know, it isn't the way it works, really. And you know it isn't. I said, can you imagine you taking on another wife, me? He got thinking about it. And anyway, the paper was a result of all that trouble that I was having with it. As I read the Doctrine and Covenants, I said, I guess I'm going to hell because I can't live this one. And Gene said, well, I sure can't either. And the paper has been a great help to a lot of, especially a lot of women. And it has made a lot of difference to them, even though that was one that got him in deep trouble. And as far as sharing things, Jeff, you didn't want to share because you didn't want to lose it. Sharing it really brings it back. And I think it's a gift. And when anybody has any kind of gift, you know, sharing it just makes it richer. It's like having a child and then another one comes along and you think, I don't think I can love that one enough. And I don't think I can love it as much as the first one. Am I going to have enough love to go around? And you do have it. And it does go around. So I just want to thank all of you who have played a part in his life and in our lives. And to know that what he did and what he stood for and what he believed in is continuing. And he wouldn't want all this attention or credit for doing something. But he is, I know, overjoyed that there continues to be a dialogue and in all ways and Sunstone, and that there are people who are committed to keep trying and making it work. because it has to do with people, and that's what really counts. Thank you.
Thank you to those who have participated by coming up and speaking, also all of you for being here. I think we'd all agree that we're better off because we knew Gene England.